more whole than when she was playing, and before she knew it, she'd spent hours on the stage. Finally, so exhausted that she could barely sit up straight, she'd went to bed despite Isling's insistent flattery, but she'd only been asleep for a matter of hours before Sonia had come and woken her up. Dahl had stayed in the common room with her the entire time, his back propped against a wall, as still as a statue, only rousing when she finally walked down from the platform and headed toward her room. The dark-skinned man had slept no more than she had, but he appeared as alert as always. "We thank you for your hospitality, Master Islin," she said, ignoring the man's question of her sleep. "Who said she couldn't be politic? But we really must be going." "Oh, mistress," he whined, his thin, stick-like fingers rubbing together anxiously. "Must you leave so soon? Surely you might stay with us one more night." "I'm sorry, but we cannot." The innkeeper sighed. "Well, at least stay to break your fast. Surely you can spare that much time, at least." Catherine hesitated, considering. Dahl had traded for two horses at the first town they'd come to once leaving Ilrica, and for the last few days they'd been hurrying, trying to put as much distance between themselves and the doomed city as possible. Although they'd stayed at several inns, their meals had been hurried, half-hearted things consisting mostly of hard bread and water, and Catherine found her mouth watering at the thought of a real cooked meal. But she knew that if she stayed any longer, the crafty innkeeper would find some way to talk her into playing again, and by the time they finally did leave, she'd be an old maid with fingers as wrinkled as prunes and a back that was permanently bent from strumming her harp. "Just one more song," she thought sourly, and shook her head. "I thank you for your offer, but I am afraid we must regretfully decline it, as we have pressing business elsewhere." The man's mouth opened in preparation to no doubt issue another protest, but Catherine continued without letting him speak. "Rest assured, however, that should my travels take me this way again, I would be most happy to stop by and direct any friends who come to the area to do so as well." Immediate greed and the potential for future profits warred in the innkeeper's expression for several seconds, but finally he nodded. "If you are sure, my lady," he said reluctantly. "Truly, it has been an honour to have one of your skill and stature grace my lowly inn." Catherine accepted the compliment with a nod, grabbed Sonia's hand, and headed toward the door. "Oh, my lady," Islin said, hurrying up beside her, an apologetic expression on his face. "I'm so sorry, but I just remembered that I have a message for you." Catherine paused, confused. "A message? For me?" The skinny innkeeper nodded, wringing his hands as he withdrew a fold of parchment from the pocket of his stained tunic. "Yes, ma'am. I should have remembered it before now. Natty tells me that I wouldn't remember to dress if she wasn't there to remind me, and with the excitement of your visit and the music you were so kind to grace us with, I must confess that it completely slipped my mind." "When did this arrive?" Catherine asked, taking the letter. The innkeeper swallowed and stared at his feet, refusing to meet her eyes.
I received the letter 2 nights past. Truly, my lady, I had not intended to—"
Catherine silenced him with a wave of her hand. She doubted very seriously that it had slipped the shrewd innkeeper's mind. More likely, he'd been concerned that the contents of the letter would force her to hurry away, taking with her his opportunity to make a few coins. Still, there was no time to worry about that now.
"Who could possibly know I was going to be here?" she thought, suddenly nervous. She was reminded of her father telling her once that a man had to look for good news, but that bad news always found him, whether he wanted it to or not.
"It is an important letter, mistress?"
the innkeeper asked, leaning over to look at it as if he hadn't had it only a moment before.
"Yes, I believe it is," she answered breathlessly,
noting the seal on the letter. The stamp was a golden, stylized picture of a hand holding a sun, and few indeed were the people who would know it for what it was, the secret mark Alatia used to contact her agents,
or the one used when one of her agents intended to contact another. The Chosen had shown it to her not long after taking her into her service, but Alaysia's agents rarely contacted each other. The Chosen preferred them to stay as autonomous as possible, and Alaysia herself had never before needed to contact Catherine outside of the appointed times. Catherine had not seen the Golden Seal since that first day in the Chosen's private chamber. For someone to try to contact Catherine in such a way, trusting the letter to the hands of the greedy innkeeper, meant that he, or she, was desperate indeed, and it was all Catherine could do to keep from tearing the letter open right then. Instead, she slid it into her bag that was draped over Dahl's shoulder. "On second thought, I doubt that it is of any great importance. Thank you," she said to the disappointed-looking innkeeper. "Still," she said, sparing a glance for Dahl, "we really must be going." It wasn't until they were on the road outside of town that Catherine reached inside the pack hanging from her horse's side, a placid, kindly mare that Sonia had taken to calling Brownie, and grasped the letter. "How difficult of a time do you imagine our dear Islin had, resisting opening it?" she asked, turning to Dahl. The dusky-skinned man met her gaze with his own eyes, so dark that they were nearly black, and without seeming to change his expression at all, his message was clear enough. "You're stalling," those eyes said, and of course they were right. All right," she said. "I suppose there's nothing to do but open it." She took a deep breath, then slowly, carefully, as if she was handling some poisonous snake instead of a letter, she peeled it open, a growing knot of unease settling in her stomach.
"Catherine, I hope that your travels find you well, and that you are taking time to enjoy yourself. Dahl is a kind man, and I would trust him above all others, but he isn't much for conversation."
Catherine snorted at this, and continued to read.
"I am writing to tell you that Tashana has asked me to visit her in Valeria on a matter of utmost importance, and by the time this letter finds you, I should already be well on my way. I ask that you meet me there with the item that you have procured as soon as possible. I look forward to seeing you. My attendants are kind enough, and although I love them all dearly, Armidan has, in his wisdom, seen fit to give them the personalities of a flock of geese. May Armidan grant you safety and blessings in your journey, and keep you always in the light. Signed, Chosen Alaysia, humble priestess of the great Lord Armidan. P.S. Please bring the girl, Sonia, with you. Hers is a kind, innocent soul, and I would very much like to meet her. Watch over her, Catherine. I have reason to believe that she may be important."
Catherine glanced around in surprise, as if expecting to see the Chosen sharing the road with them, then caught herself. Armidan's blessing manifested itself differently in each Chosen. Although all of the six were granted longer lives than normal mortals, as well as greater strength and magic, Alaysia was the only one that had ever shown any ability at foretelling. No matter how much time she spent with the Chosen, she couldn't get used to the idea that the woman could know what was going to happen before it ever did, or in this case, know what was happening hundreds of miles away. She'd asked Alaysia about it once, and the old woman had claimed that, for the most part, that manifestation of her gift was like trying to guess a man's identity by seeing his outline cloaked in shadow, or trying to read a book when four words out of five were missing. Rarely, she'd said, did she receive anything more than nonsensical fragments, and Catherine couldn't help her own surprise that the Chosen had apparently seen Sonia so clearly. She handed the note to Dahl, who read it in silence, his face showing no emotion until the end, when he turned to Catherine with one eyebrow raised, the only indication that he, too, had been surprised by the Chosen's words about the little girl. She met his eyes for a moment, then nodded. "It looks like our plans have changed."
Chapter 34
Alesh bit back a sigh of exasperation as he watched Garn stumble up from the ground for at least the sixth or seventh time in an hour. Since leaving the inn the day before, the Lightbringer had been drinking even more than normal, which was to say, he'd drank enough alcohol to drown an army in.
Alesh couldn't imagine where the man got it all, but he didn't like it. The day before, when night had been coming on, Garn had stumbled into the woods and fallen asleep without so much as lighting a single fire, and no matter how hard Alesh had tried, he'd been unable to rouse him. Luckily, he'd paid enough attention to the Lightbringer's use of the herbs he carried that he'd been able to gather wood and make a fire to keep the Nightwalkers at bay. It had been a terrifying night, listening to the snuffling, slinking sounds of the creatures in the woods around them, and knowing that the only thing keeping them from tearing him and the bearded man apart was a fire he'd created with herbs he didn't even know the name of. The wind had been strong, gusting against the fire as if guided by the hand of some malevolent god, and he'd sat with his sword in his hands, sure that at any moment the flame would go out and the Nightlings would charge in to claim their prize, the prize they were cheated out of so many years ago. And had Garn shown any appreciation that he was still breathing this morning? Of course not. In fact, the man had been even surlier than usual, an achievement Alesh would have thought impossible until a few hours ago. He'd asked the man what was wrong, but his attempts at conversation had been met with grunts or outright silence. After a time, Alesh had given up. The man wasn't going to talk to him, no matter how hard he tried, and he had things of his own to worry about. Things like making it to Valeria and warning chosen Teshana of Kael's betrayal. Things like finding Sonya. Every time he thought of the girl, so young and innocent, he felt a stab of guilt. He was sure that once he told her what was happening, the Chosen would send an army to cast Kael and the Redeemers down, knew that he stood a better chance of saving Sonya that way than searching an entire city for her, dodging soldiers with each step. But that didn't change the fact that he felt like he was betraying the girl who'd trusted him to keep her safe.
"Come on. We'll make camp over there."
Alesh started at the sound of the man's voice, staring around in surprise. He'd been so lost in his own thoughts that he hadn't been aware of the deepening gloom. He glanced to where Garn had pointed, and blinked to be sure he was seeing it right. A circular crater that was at least 100 feet in length sat in the middle of the trees. There was no grass, and the hard-packed soil looked black. There were no trees inside that ring of devastation, no plant growth at all, and those few stubborn specimens that stood at the crater's edge were twisted and bent outward, as if they'd preferred escape from whatever force had been unleashed there even more than they did the vital light of the sun. To Alesh, it looked like some giant had smashed his fist into the ground in a fit of rage.
"Where is this place?" he asked.
"Don't you know anything?" Garn asked with a sneer. "This is Shyla's Fell."
Alesh's mouth dropped open in surprise. Of course he'd heard of Shyla's Fell. Everyone had. But he'd never expected to actually see it. There had been a point, about midway through the war, when it had looked as if the humans were going to lose. No matter what the Chosen did, Argush and his army were always ready to counter it, always lying in wait to ambush the armies of men when they weren't prepared, to attack them at their weakest point, and no one could figure out how. Armidan's six had, of course, been the leaders of the army, and Olimon first among those, but they'd been priests and priestesses, not generals or military strategists. Even Teshana, who would later become known as the greatest tactician the world had ever seen, had known nothing of warfare in the early days, and the six had needed a man with experience to command their armies. They found what they needed in a man named Shyla Aledrian, by all accounts a gruff but incredibly cunning general, and, as it happened, Olimon's closest friend. According to the books Alesh had read, the man had been a nearly peerless swordsman, but, more importantly, he was also one of the greatest generals the world had ever seen, and, at first, he validated the Six's faith in him by pulling the human armies out of near-certain defeat again and again, winning victory after victory, despite his army being significantly outnumbered. In the early days of the war, his name was whispered with almost as much reverence as Olimon himself, and it was the two of them, more than anyone else, that were considered the saviors of humanity. Now, however, he wasn't known for being a master swordsman or an extremely intelligent and capable general, but instead as what he was, the world's most famous traitor,
singularly responsible for the deaths of thousands of soldiers and very nearly the defeat of the human armies. The stories claimed that Olimon learned of Shyla's treachery, and he and a few scouts confronted the traitorous general at the same spot that Alesh now stood. They came upon Shyla meeting with a small delegation sent from Argushi's army. An eyewitness account from one of the scouts claimed that upon finding Shyla so engaged, the Chosen went into a rage. He drew deeply on the power of his god, and his very eyes shone a gold so brilliant they were painful to look upon, and that when he began to tear into the Nightwalkers like some avenging god himself, thin wisps of golden light trailed from his body. With the smoking corpses of the creatures lying about them in grotesque heaps, Olimon and his friend fought into the night. The Chosen, too, had been a renowned swordsman, and the scholars said that the fight lasted the rest of the night, both men drawing on all of their skill and training, fighting to the point of exhaustion, and then past it. Then, with the first light of dawn rising in the sky, Olimon smote Shyla with his sword, and, once his friend lay writhing on the forest floor, defeated and dying, the Chosen called upon the power of his god, and fire and lightning blasted Shyla's body and the landscape surrounding it. Olimon cursed the ground on which he'd fallen, so that never again would it be given the gift of life, but would lie dead and useless forever, the unmarked grave of a man who had betrayed his people. To this day, no one knew why Shyla had done what he had, and his name was a byword for traitors all over the kingdom. Being at the sight of the Chosen's betrayal, Alesh felt an almost unbearable sadness for Olimon. Despite the many blessings given him by Amidan, or perhaps because of them, Olimon had suffered more than few men ever had. Standing there before that crater of scorched earth, Alesh found himself unable to speak. Reading of the place was one thing, but seeing it, seeing the blackened ground, tasting the dead air that permeated the area around the clearing, and staring at the warped trees struggling away from the desolation in their midst, was quite another. He followed Garn into the woods nearby, stumbling over a tree root and almost falling because he couldn't seem to pull his eyes off of the burned-out crater. Night had almost completely arrived by the time they were finished setting up camp, and, without a word, Garn lay down to sleep. Alesh sat by the fire, staring into the darkness toward where he knew the crater lay, and a deep melancholy overcame him as he thought of those he'd lost. What was the point of all of it? Olimon had defeated Shyla, but in the end, it seemed that everything he'd spent his entire life building was falling apart just the same. A man could hold a light up to the night, could venture out to meet it and push the shadows back. But sooner or later, all lights died, and the darkness was nothing if not patient. After a time, Garn turned and looked at him. The firelight reflected in the Lightbringer's eyes gave them a sullen orange glow. But when he spoke, his voice was almost sympathetic.
"It's a bad place, boy. I know that. But we'll only have to suffer it for a night. Here."
He reached into his pack and tossed Alesh a flask.
"Take a drink. Sometimes the world is sharp enough to cut, but a few drinks will soften the edges a bit, and you need your sleep."
He glanced away into the darkness. Then, in a voice barely loud enough for Alesh to hear,
"A man can stomach anything, if he has to."
Alesh had never been much of a drinker. He only had a small amount of control in his life, and he didn't like the idea of giving that bit up to drunkenness. But just then, there were a lot of hard edges that needed smoothing. So he took a large pull from the flask, wincing as it traced a line of liquid fire down his throat, and tossed it back to the Lightbringer. "Thanks," he said, and meant it. The man grunted and put the flask away before lying down again, the small kindness apparently taking its toll. Alesh wondered that the Lightbringer could sleep in such a place. The trees made it impossible to see the crater, but he could feel it out there just the same, festering like some great blight on the face of the land. "I'll be lucky if I ever sleep again," he thought. And he was preparing himself for another long night spent listening to creatures in the darkness, thinking of smoke and fire, of blood and corpses, when his eyelids suddenly felt impossibly heavy. He lay down and thought of his friends, of Ahriman, and his parents, and the Nightlings, and, in another moment, nothing at all.
Chapter 35 His mother's scream was muffled by the wagon's compartment, but he could hear the fear, the hysteria in it. A moment more and his father's shouting joined hers, ragged cries of rage and despair. There was a bone-jarring impact, and Alesha's head slammed into the slat of wood that enclosed the compartment. He bit his tongue, tasted the coppery tang of blood, and then they were flipping through the air, end over end, each revolution slamming him against the inside of the wagon and sending sharp lances of agony through his body. The wagon crashed to the earth, wood snapping and shattering with the force of its landing. Alesha's head struck the side of the wagon again, and white light flashed in his eyes. He lay, dazed, feeling as if every bone in his body had been broken. Outside, something growled in what sounded like satisfaction. Then other voices joined it, growling and shrieking in maddening, terrible circles that sent a shiver of terror through him.
"Get away from her, you bastards!"
his father's voice, almost as feral, as bestial as the others.
"Torek!"
his mother screamed.
"Watch out!"
His father answered in a wordless howl of fury and pain that seemed to go on forever. Then there was a violent ripping sound, and abruptly his father's cries cut off. His mother screamed, her voice breaking into heart-wrenching sobs that could be heard over the cacophony of growls and snarls that seemed to come from every direction.
"Ahriman, Father of Light, please—"
That terrible tearing sound came again, and then she, too, was silent. Inhuman voices howled and cried out their triumph, a blood-curdling chorus that was by far the worst sound Alesha had ever heard, until they began to feed.
"Please, no,"
Alesha thought.
"This isn't how it happened. I wasn't awake."
But the dream did not stop, and he laid there, his body crying out in pain, and listened to the wet, slurping noises until, finally, they ended. He felt a wash of relief when the noises stopped, but in another moment a snuffling came from outside the wagon, a sound that reminded Alesha of a dog searching for a scent.
"They can smell me,"
his fear-addled mind had time to register. Then the wagon gave a violent lurch, the wood creaking in protest as something jerked at the compartment door. Alesha's cry of fear was answered by an ear-splitting roar, and the wagon gave a lurch even more powerful than the first. Wood cracked, and a chunk of the compartment's door came free in a shower of splinters. Alesha watched the finger-length claws tearing at the wood with something almost like relief. He would be with his parents again. Soon.
"My father's name is Torek," he thought.
Then he closed his eyes and waited for the end.
"Alesha?"
A strangely familiar voice spoke inside of his head.
"You must awake."
He pushed the voice away, tried to ignore it. He'd been alone for too long. This time would be different. This time he would be with his parents.
"Wake up."
The words came again, more insistent this time. He watched as the remnants of the doorway were torn free and thrown aside. An impossibly large form stared down at him. He could see little more than its shadow in the darkness, and its eyes. Glowing a deep red like blood, a gaze that held no hint of compassion, no understanding of mercy or kindness. Eyes that knew only death, only blood, and the screams of the dying. Alesha felt hands on him, tugging at him. He expected at any moment to feel those claws so long and sharp, but the grip that held him was almost gentle.
"Alesha," the voice said again. "You have to wake up."
He felt himself being pulled, and he fought against it, struggled to tear free. But though the grip was gentle, it was powerful, and he might as well have been a child struggling against a grown man.
"Alesha, wake up now!"
Alesha jerked to his feet, his hands pressed tightly against his temple as the dying echoes of the shout faded. He felt as if his head might explode, but in another moment the pain was gone. Suddenly,
he was overcome with the feeling that he was in some terrible danger, and he had the almost irresistible urge to run, to get away. "Relax," he told himself, taking slow, deep breaths, wiping hair lank with sweat out of his face. "It was just the dream, that's all. Everything's fine." Still, the feeling wouldn't go away. He glanced at the fire that was still burning brightly, pushing back the darkness. The sight should have reassured him, but for some reason it didn't. He decided then that, foolish or not, he'd feel better with the sword in his hand. He walked to where he'd left it and found, to his surprise, that it was gone. He was still looking for it when he heard footsteps behind him.
"Looking for this?" asked a voice he didn't recognize.
Alesh whipped around. In the firelight, the man's face looked hard, severe. A jagged, bone-white scar traced its way down one cheek. It was a soldier's face, and the cruel smile the man wore did nothing to soften its hard lines and edges. The man, like the five that stood behind him, was dressed in a suit of midnight black armor, and a long red cape hung from his back.
"Redeemers?"
Alesh asked, confused.
"But how—"
He backed up a step, and started as he bumped into something. Turning, his hands coming up to defend himself, he nearly lashed out before he saw that the man behind him wasn't one of the soldiers, but the bearded Lightbringer.
"Gone,"
he said, grabbing the man by the arm.
"Quick, we have to get out of here."
Garn shook his hand off, and took a long pull from the liquor flask that had become all too familiar in their days on the road.
"It's no use, boy. Where can you run? If you try to escape, the Nightwalkers will get you."
"Come on! We can make it,"
Alesh said, grabbing the man's arm again and suddenly freezing as realization rocked him.
"You." He'd said, "You."
He met the Lightbringer's gaze, a terrible calm settling over him.
"You betrayed me,"
he said, a statement, not a question. Garn's face twisted in sudden fury.
"I'm no traitor, boy,"
he shouted. He stared at Alesh, his eyes narrowed, daring him to argue. When he didn't, the Lightbringer went on in a lower voice.
"I went back downstairs at the inn last night, figuring to get myself a drink no matter what that big bastard Tassin said. I didn't. The son of a bitch was guarding it like it was his only daughter's virtue. But imagine my surprise when a man comes up to me and starts asking if I'd seen someone matching your description. This fella, he told me that the man he was looking for was responsible for Chosen Ahriman's death."
"That's a lie,"
Alesh said, but with little feeling. He doubted that the Lightbringer believed it himself, but he'd no doubt been promised a reward for turning Alesh in.
"I'm sorry, Erwin,"
he thought, with something like relief. "I tried."
"What did you expect me to do, huh?"
Garn asked, in an angry, defensive voice.
"Die for you? You asked me before how I survived when the others were all taken or killed. Well, boy, I'll tell you how. I'm a survivor. I'm alive, and I intend to stay that way. And if I have to choose between my life and yours, or Merrick, and those other stupid, stubborn bastards, well, that ain't much of a choice at all, is it?"
"You gave them up," Alesh said, knowing it was true as he spoke it. "But how? Why? Lightbringers are supposed to be the bravest of men. They're supposed to be heroes." Garn snorted and spat disdainfully.
"I was trained to fight nightlings, not men. Besides, I'd rather be a living coward than a dead hero any day."
"Enough talk," the Redeemer who'd spoken before growled. "Bind him, Lightbringer. We start back to Ulrica immediately."
"Yes, Captain. And you'll keep to your end of the deal?"
Garn asked, an uncertain, almost pleading tone in his gruff voice. The scarred man smiled.
"Oh, yes. Why, I'm sure that the Chosen will have some use for a man as loyal as yourself."
Garn nodded and withdrew a coil of rope from his belt.
"They're going to kill you, Garn,"
Alesh said in a cold, emotionless voice, as the Lightbringer stepped behind him.
You know that, don't you?
Shut your damned mouth. You don't know a night-cursed thing.
Aless laughed, but there was no humour in it.
What do you think, Garn? That Kael's going to kill all of the others and, out of the goodness of his heart, decide to spare you?
He shook his head contemptuously. You are even more a fool than you are a coward.
I told you to keep your mouth shut,
the Lightbringer growled, striking Aless hard in the back of the head. It hurt, but he'd taken harder in his training sessions with Kael, and it was what he'd been waiting for. He spun with the blow, turning and planting a fist in the bearded man's stomach. Garn's breath left him in a gasp. Before he could recover, Aless whipped his hand out and struck the Lightbringer in the throat. Garn stumbled back, clawing at his throat, tripped, and sprawled on the ground in a writhing heap.
"Get him, you stupid bastards!"
the captain shouted, and the men rushed forward. Instead of turning to face them, Aless knelt beside the writhing Lightbringer and dug through the man's tunic. A crossbow bolt whistled by him, close enough for him to feel the wind of its passage.
"Don't kill him, you fool!" the captain shouted. "The Chosen wants him alive!"
Not daring to take time to think about what he was doing, Aless withdrew two massive handfuls of Pralentia, all that was left in the Lightbringer's pouch, and many times more than he'd ever seen Garn use, and threw them toward the fire and the single torch that one of the Redeemers carried. The leaves turned from black to red while still in the air, swelling as they absorbed the light and heat of the flames. Then they burst in a blinding shower of sparks. When the light faded and died, the clearing was left in complete darkness. Aless withdrew the evertorch from his tunic and turned to run, thankful that he'd not left the cylinder with his other belongings for fear of it being damaged. He'd only made it a few steps when something whistled out of the darkness and slammed into his left shoulder. He screamed as pain exploded in his arm, staggered, and only just managed to keep his feet. He reached to his shoulder with his other hand, and his fingers brushed against a thin length of wood. He hissed as the arrow shifted at his touch, and sent hot lines of agony through his left side. Apparently, one of the soldiers had decided that Kael would have to be satisfied with a dead traitor to hang from the city's walls. He shuffled forward uncertainly, the pain making him dizzy. Just a little farther, and he could use the evertorch to drive back the creatures that, even now, were no doubt skulking forward, surrounding him and the others. He took one step, then another, sweating and growling at the effort. His legs gave out on him on the next step, and he fell to his knees. He wasn't as far away from the others as he would have liked, but it would have to do. Not thinking, he tried to raise the hand holding the evertorch, his wounded hand, and a fresh wave of pain lanced through him, making his stomach roil threateningly. Gritting his teeth, he reached for it with his right hand and gasped in shock. The evertorch was gone. It must have fallen out of his grasp when he'd been struck.
"Damn it!"
he hissed. Desperate, expecting one of the creatures to come tearing out of the woods any second, he dropped to all fours and began pawing at the forest floor around him with his one working hand.
"Someone make a fire now and get that bastard!"
the captain screamed somewhere in the nearby darkness. Aless noted, even as a part of him shrieked and jabbered in fear, that the calm assurance had vanished from the captain's voice.
"I can't see a thing!"
one of the other Redeemers shouted in a terrified voice. There was a loud rustling a short distance away, and when the man spoke again, his voice quavered like that of a child.
Wait, what is...
The rest of his words were drowned out by a bone-chilling howl that sliced through the night. Another followed shortly after, then another, and soon the inhuman growls and cries rose in a chorus louder than any thunderstorm. Those hungry cries sent shivers of panic rushing through Aless, and he tore at the ground with renewed energy, his heart hammering in his chest.
"Oh, no! Oh, gods, no!"
someone whimpered, and Aless heard the sounds of rushing footsteps as one of the men, mad with terror, bolted into the surrounding woods. The captain screamed at the man to come back, but if the man heard, he gave no sign. For a moment, Aless almost ran after him, but he fought down the urge to flee, and continued to scrabble at the forest floor, desperately flicking away sticks and leaves. A few seconds later, a scream erupted from the direction in which the man had run, a gut-wrenching, horror-inspiring sound that was, in its way,
worse even than the growls and shrieks of the creatures around them. Alesh felt a flash of pity, but pushed it away. If the Redeemers had their way, he'd be led back to Ilreka in chains, only to be executed at Kale's leisure. Of course, he might regret his choice if he didn't manage to find the Evertort soon. Without it, he would surely die, and in a way much more horrible than Kale could ever dream of. Something in the night let out a growl reminiscent of the sounds a dog might make when worrying at a bone, and the man's screams cut off. Silence, deep and heavy, fell on the clearing, and Alesh paused in his search, not daring to so much as breathe lest he draw attention to himself. Then, as if on cue, the forest erupted with the sounds of twigs and branches snapping. He could just make out the vague shapes of creatures gliding forward in the darkness, coming at the clearing from all directions. The Redeemers began to curse or whimper prayers to their goddess Shira, but she, like Armidan, did not answer, and dozens of pairs of yellow and red glowing eyes began to appear in the shadows. Then they were among the soldiers, and the prayers of the men quickly turned to tortured, dying screams. Alesh clawed at the ground with both hands now, the pain of his wound nearly forgotten in his fear. He was still searching, cursing under his breath, when something exploded out of the darkness to his left. He barely had time to raise an arm in defense before the creature barreled into him with the strength of a galloping horse, knocking him over and sending him sprawling. The nightling was on him before he could rise, and he screamed as dagger-sharp claws traced lines of white-hot pain down his sides. He grabbed wildly at the shadowy shape astride him, and, after a desperate struggle, his hands closed upon two limbs as thin as a child's arms. The creature's flesh felt oily and scaled in the darkness, like the body of a snake, and, despite its thinness, it took every bit of Alesh's failing strength to hold it at bay. Something wet, blood or drool, fell on his face as the creature hissed in frustration and hunger, and he shouted in agony as two claws, those of the creature's back legs, dug into his thighs. Grunting with effort, he rolled backward and kicked out with both legs, screaming as the claws tore out of his flesh with a sickening squelch. The nightling let out a cry of pain or frustration as it tumbled through the air and disappeared into the waiting darkness. His breath coming in ragged gasps, Alesh struggled to his feet. Shadows began to gather at the corner of his vision, but he shook his head, willing them away. If he was going to die, he was going to die standing.
"Come on, then, you bastard!"
he grated, unable to hear himself over the screams and death throes of the soldiers around him. As if it understood him, the creature appeared a short distance away, its red eyes like pinpricks of blood on a curtain of pitch. The Nightwalker hissed and surged forward impossibly quick. Alesh braced for it, as Olimun had shown him, his hands in front of him, his knees bent, his muscles taut in anticipation. But just before the creature was on him, something slammed into him from out of the darkness. Alesh was flung through the air as if he weighed no more than a child, and he crashed to the earth more than 10 feet away from where he'd been standing, his head striking the hard-packed earth. He looked back to where he'd been standing a moment before, but darkness pushed insistently at the edges of his vision, and he could see nothing but a shadowy figure approaching him.
"Get up," he told himself. "You have to get up."
But, try as he might, his body refused to obey his commands, and he found himself feeling more tired, more exhausted than he ever had in his life. Why should he bother, really? It was easier to lie still, to stop fighting. He could see them again, all of them. Corin, Abigail, Arliman, his mother, his father. They were waiting for him.
"Torric," he thought, blinking. "My father's name."
The darkness rushed forward, and he knew nothing more. Chapter 36 Rion stifled a yawn as Severin retold the story, was it the third time now, or the fourth, of how he'd managed to bed Lady Elisa. The hawk-faced man recounted the events of the previous evening with a dramatic flair, as if it was a feat on par with Armidan granting the people of Entana the knowledge of fire thousands of years ago. Of course, all of this ignored the fact that Lady Elisa was known for such dalliances,
and that bragging about such a thing was, in Rion's mind at least, like a card player bragging about pulling a trump out of his sleeve. For their part, Armiel and Bastion were leaned forward in their seats, listening eagerly, as if they hadn't just heard the same story no more than an hour ago. The young noble's eyes were wide, his cheeks a bright red, and the fat future priest's mouth worked soundlessly, as if the story made him hungry, which Rion supposed it probably did. Everything did, after all. Fools, all of them, Rion thought. But rich fools, and that's enough. It has to be. Still, the thought of sitting and listening to them much longer was an almost impossibly depressing one, and he couldn't stop the sigh that escaped his mouth.
"Oh, I'm sorry, Ariandrian," Severin said, running a hand through his slick black hair, as was his habit. "Am I boring you?"
Rion gave him a small smile.
"Oh, I wouldn't say I'm bored, Severin. I was bored the first time you told the story. I've long since progressed to a comfortable state of discontent."
The nobleman frowned as he motioned to a nearby servant to refill his drink.
"Perhaps you would be wise to listen more carefully, Ariandrian. You might learn a thing or two about how to woo the fairer sex. That is, of course, if you want to do such a thing. As I hear it, you haven't shown much interest to Lady Alindia, despite her overt advances."
He smiled.
"Maybe you and that blacksmith are better friends than I've realized."
Rion's expression went blank. Alindia, like many of the noble women in the city, was interested in his father's estate, not Rion himself, and the truth was that Rion couldn't stand the childish pouting and simpering so common to most spoiled noble women.
"Oh, I enjoy the company of women as much as anyone," he said. "The difference between me and you is really no more than a question of standards. For you, it is enough that they have managed to fit themselves into a dress, while I..."
He hesitated. The truth was, he had no idea what he wanted in a woman. He just knew that he wasn't interested in the pampered, face-painted sheep that made up the city's noblewomen. Severin rolled his eyes.
"I'm more interested in whether or not they can get themselves out of the dress than into it, friend Rion. Still," he said, waving a hand in a gesture that encompassed the dozens of people dancing in the ballroom, as well as the women standing in small groups, servants hurrying to and fro to attend their needs. "Surely among so many of the city's finest, you could find someone that fits your standards. Why, it's been over a year since you courted Lady Marcilla. Too much longer, and people may begin to whisper. Which means that you already are, you arrogant bastard."
It was Rian's turn to frown. He had courted Marcilla for over 2 months, and for a time she'd seemed different than the other noble women, more concerned with the politics of the city and chosen Teshana's latest laws than with dresses or balls. Of course, it hadn't taken long before Rion discovered that she wanted to use a connection with his house as a lever to achieve a position of authority on the city council. That was the problem with being one of the richest, most powerful noble houses in the city, or at least being thought to be one at any rate. When people looked at you, they didn't see you, but your name. Thinking of Marcilla, Rion felt himself growing angry, and he patted the handle of the thin dueling rapier at his side. Such whispers can be remedied easily enough, particularly if someone is brazen enough to speak them to my face. In truth, the swords they all had belted at their sides were more for show than anything, a tradition that was said to have once symbolized the willingness of the nobles to always be prepared to fight for their city and their ruler. But since then the meaning had been lost, and they were worn now merely for fashion's sake. Still, the gesture seemed clear enough to Severin, and the black-haired man smirked confidently. As well he should. The nobleman was known as being one of the finest duelists in Valeria, which, Rion suspected, was most likely a necessary product of his apparent quest to sleep with every noblewoman, married or not, in the city. Severin was just opening his mouth to reply, when Armiel spoke hurriedly, his voice worried.
"Come on, friends. There is no need to bicker. Severin, there's no question of your prowess, both with women"—he gave Rion a pointed look—"as well as the blade.
And, Rian, we all know that you've been too busy running your family's estate to spend your time courting. In fact, I'm surprised that you even had time to come tonight.
Yes, Severin drawled in a bored tone. Shocking.
Ah, he said, turning to look at a noblewoman dressed in a black dress of mourning that had just entered the ballroom. If it isn't Lady Annelle. I would not have expected her to be out so soon after her poor husband's passing to the wasting sickness. What was it, a fortnight ago?
He turned back to them with a wink.
Perhaps she could use some comforting.
This said, he rose and sauntered away in the direction of the distracted-looking noblewoman. Rian frowned as he watched him go. In Valeria, it was custom for a woman or man to wear black for a month after their spouse's passing respect for the dead, and although she was observing the practice of it, the sultry smile Lady Annelle gave the approaching Severin made Rian suspect that the purpose of the custom had been lost on her. Suddenly, the thought of sitting among the noblemen for a second longer was intolerable, and Rian rose from his cushioned chair.
"I'm sorry, friends, but I, too, must go."
"What?"
Armiel asked, surprised.
"Why, you've only just got here, Heriandrian. Surely you need not leave so soon."
"I'm afraid I must," he said, standing patiently as a servant brought his sable cloak and draped it over his shoulders, fastening it around his neck with a golden clasp in the shape of a coin. "As you have said, the running of my family's business is a busy job, and there are matters that demand my attention." The young nobleman's lips turned into a pout, like a child being forced to bed against his wishes.
"Very well. But father is hosting a ball at our estate next week. Promise that you'll come."
Rian nodded.
"I will come if I can, Armiel.
If I can stomach the thought of spending my time with a bunch of noble fools with more money than sense, that is." He turned to walk away.
"Oh, and Eriandrian?"
Rian glanced back at the nobleman, raising an eyebrow in question. The young lord's face had an anxious cast.
"You should be careful about how you talk to Severin. You know his father has been paying one of the Ekirani blade masters to train him since he could barely walk. You wouldn't have a chance against him in a duel."
Rian smiled calmly at the nobleman.
"Oh, there's always a chance, Armiel. It's what makes life so interesting."
He'd only just finished speaking when a man's laughter, loud and deep, rang out directly behind him. He whipped around with a grunt, but no one was there, and the closest of the ball's attendees, a man and woman of minor houses, were far too engaged with each other and their wine to have been the one he'd heard. Besides, he still heard the laughter, though it was growing weaker, fading, as if its owner were across the room from them and walking away. After another second, it vanished altogether.
"Are you all right, Heriandrian?"
"Hmm?"
He turned to see Armiel staring at him, a curious expression on his face. Even Bastian had pulled himself away from his meal long enough to look at Rian with a greasy, uncertain smile on his lips. Rian followed their gazes to his hand and was surprised to find that he'd drawn his sword half out of its scabbard. Coughing, he slid it back and made a show of adjusting it as if it was out of place.
"I'm fine," he said. "But I really must be going. Stay in the light, Armiel. Bastian."
Armiel frowned, but nodded.
"And you, Heriandrian?"
The future priest gave a quick, dismissive nod, his attention once more occupied by the leg of mutton that was, even now, dripping grease and fat onto his chin and white tunic as he took massive, hungry bites out of it. "You may as well put the clothes on a mongrel dog," Rian thought disgustedly. "They'd stay cleaner that way." As he left the ballroom, he watched the other attendees, but no one so much as glanced in his direction, all of them too busy drinking and dining, laughing and flirting. "I just need some rest, that's all," he told himself, with a confidence he didn't feel as he made his way past the tables. "That's all." Yet, try as he might, he couldn't shake the feeling that someone was watching him. Watching and laughing. This late in the evening, the streets of Valeria held few people, and the lanterns placed at intervals along the streets did little to fight back the shadows that crept along the street and slithered up the sides of buildings like living things.
Rian had always felt most comfortable in the night, where a man was only a vague shape in the darkness and no one knew or cared who his family was, when a man was only responsible for himself and no one else. But not tonight. Tonight, he felt hunted. He took a slow, deep breath, telling himself that he was being paranoid, and started toward the Golden Torch. He'd traveled this street many times, and its familiarity should have comforted him, but it did not. In the darkness, the buildings seemed to huddle around him, to stoop and mark his progress with malevolent stares, and those few people that shared the streets with him were cruel spectres, their eyes shining like liquid fire in the orange glow of the street lanterns. He found himself shying away from them as they passed, wincing at every creaking door or raucous shout from a nearby bar. He passed several city guards going about their nightly patrols, and it was all he could do to keep from running up to them and begging for help. He felt terrified, and what was worse, he felt helpless. Helpless in a way that he hadn't felt since he'd been a child, cowering in his bed and staring wide-eyed at the shadows in his room, as his mind replayed one of the stories the merchants, who sometimes came to his father's manse, were so fond of telling. Stories full of swords and blood, nightwalkers and lies. "You're being a damned fool," he cursed himself. But the feeling of being hunted grew worse with each step he took. He was only a few streets away from the torch when the laughter sounded behind him. He let out a cry of surprise, and gripping the handle of his sword tightly, spun to meet his pursuers. His sword had almost completely cleared its scabbard before he realized that his pursuers were a portly man, a noble, judging by his fine clothes, and a middle-aged, equally portly woman whose overly painted face and revealing dress marked her as a professional. The two had just stumbled out of a nearby inn, laughing and nearly falling over each other. They'd taken several steps toward Rian before noticing him, and the man broke off from fondling the woman's drooping breasts long enough to turn a drunken leer on Rian.
"Eh? What do you aim to do with that?"
Rian, heart still galloping in his chest, raised his other hand in apology. "I'm sorry. I didn't mean to startle you."
"Oh, I wouldn't think nothing of it, hun,"
the woman said, leering and giving him what he supposed was meant to be an enticing wink.
"I've seen bigger, and they don't scare me none."
She cackled at her own joke, and the man with her frowned slightly. She leaned closer, eyeing Rian like a horse at market.
"Well, but you're a cute one, aren't you? Tell you what, sweetie, you call on me later, huh? Lorna will find you a place to put your sword in, yes she will."
Rian coughed uncomfortably and slid the blade back into its scabbard. He opened his mouth to respond, but could think of nothing to say. Luckily, he was saved from an overly long, uncomfortable silence as the man grunted in anger, apparently only just catching up with the conversation.
"Hey, now," he said,
jerking on the woman's arm roughly.
"I didn't pay so as to listen to your damn talking, did I?"
The woman let out a small, obviously feigned cry of surprise, and winked at Rian before letting herself be dragged down the road. Rian watched the two go, cursing himself again. He waited for them to disappear down the street, before heading out himself. "What's happening to me?" he thought as he walked. "Is this what it's like to lose your mind?" And it wasn't just that he'd nearly cut down a prostitute and a drunk, was it? No, not just that. Armiel might be a spoiled child, but he'd been right to worry. Severin was a fool who used his family's power in the city like a weapon, beating down those below his station and using it to take advantage of women. But Armiel was right when he said that Rian would stand little chance in a duel against him. So why, then, had he all but challenged the man? Challenge a man trained by an Ekirani blade master since he was a child? It would have been a mistake, but, fortunately or not, not one that he would have had to live with for long. The Ekirani were the people of the small, distant island Ekiran, the young men of which were trained from birth in what they called the dance. Only the very best of these were given the honor of being named blade masters. Little was known about the Ekirani, taller and thinner than their Entanan cousins, but their skill and knowledge in all matters of war were unquestioned. The Ekirani were not just trained in swordplay, but in battle strategy as well, dedicating themselves to war and battle with a religious fervour. The fact that they were said to worship Peirin, god of conflict, son of the Primes, Shira and Armidan, and twin to Javan, the god of chance, even above Armidan himself, was enough for them to be declared heretics and blasphemers by the Church of Armidan and the whole of Entana. Declared quietly, of course, and never around one of the Blademasters themselves. Blasphemers or not, noblemen paid exorbitant prices to hire companies of the Blademasters for their small standing armies, or to make use of them as bodyguards. Only the richest of the noblemen could afford such a thing, but many believed it well worth the price, as common belief considered one Ekirani to be worth a dozen regular soldiers or more in a fight, and Ekirani generals were said to be the most brilliant military minds of the age. It was proof of Lord Ulrich's fortune that he could afford to hire one of the legendary warriors to train his son in the use of the blade, a tutor that was envied by all of the city's noble houses. Rian finally made it to his room at the torch, and began the process of changing into his ragged clothes and threadbare cloak. Next, he withdrew several daggers from the chest at the foot of the bed, and began secreting them in hidden loops and sheaths under his clothing. As he did, Rian reflected that while Ekirani blade masters were said to be harsh in their education, the streets of Valeria had their own lessons to teach, and the punishment for failure was nothing so small as a cuff upside the head or an extra mile tallied to the day's jog. The blade masters, the street. There were many teachers a man might have, and many ways that he might learn. Chapter 37 Alesh awoke in agony. He tried to scream, but the sound came out as little more than a dry, rattling croak. The memories came back in a rush, memories of the nightlings with their claws like daggers and their hungry, malevolent growls. He forced his eyes open, and gasped hoarsely in surprise, as blinding light lanced into his vision. It was as if the sun itself, the great torch that Armidan had hung in the sky thousands of years ago when he created his children and gave them the gift of light, had crashed to the earth. Grass rustled beside him. He tried to turn, to rise, but the pain crested, threatening to jerk him back down into unconsciousness. Suddenly, a figure appeared over him, and the dazzling light grew brighter still. He squeezed his eyes shut, but soon realized it did no good, and opened them again, squinting. He tried to look away, but again his battered body wouldn't move, and he noticed something strange. The light wasn't coming from above or behind the figure, but from the figure itself, radiating out as if he or she was some great torch or lantern. A fever dream, he thought to himself. Random images in my mind as I die, nothing more. And there really wasn't any question that he was dying. The pain was a promise of that much. His skin burned as if it had been set alight, and the wound in his shoulder throbbed with a viciousness that left him short of breath. His thighs, too, blazed where the creature's claws had scored him. "Finish it already, you bastards," he thought wildly. But as soon as he thought it, he realized that he could no longer hear the snuffles and growls of the nightwalkers. There was the silence, and his own gasping breaths, and nothing more. "Your brain's addled. You're dying, all right. That's the only way this ends." The figure above him seemed to move, a blur of motion as if seen through water, and pain exploded in his shoulder, sudden and violent, and all his thoughts disappeared in a roiling sea of anguish. He tried to scream again, and found that he could, after all. He screamed, and he screamed, and then he passed out. When he awoke again, he was lying on his back. His tongue felt thick and impossibly dry, like a piece of charred firewood in his mouth. His wounds still throbbed, but the excruciating pain had subsided to bearable, and he found that he could think clearly, though he still felt impossibly weak. A steady, rushing, burbling sound came from somewhere close by. A river? But where am I? Remembering the painful brightness of before, he opened his eyes slowly. Light spilled into his vision, but it was the normal glow of the morning sun, not the shocking, impossibly bright light of before. Sunlight? He thought. But how? For that matter, why am I still alive?
People didn't survive a night spent in darkness, not any more. Maybe never again. Which means... The priests of Amidan said that the sun always shone in the land of the dead, and that there was no pain. Well, they were wrong. He might not be